OW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. State lawmakers have been hard at work in Olympia. Very late last night, they closed a last-minute loophole in the estate tax just hours before refund checks were to go out in the mail. Governor Inslee signed that into law this morning. We're going to have more on that and other political news in the second hour of the show with our panel of journalists. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday unanimously ruled that human genes may not be patented. Many scientists and researchers hailed the news. Among them was University of Washington professor Mary Claire King. She discovered the genes are at the heart of this ruling while she was at the University of California at Berkeley as a child. She's with us today. That was 1990. That was quite some time ago.
Indeed.
Thanks for coming in. Remind us about the two genes that are at the heart of this case.
Right. So, well, thanks for saying I was a child at Berkeley. The work that my little group and I did at Berkeley to identify the location of the gene BRCA1 started in 1974 and culminated with a definitive location on a particular chromosome, 17, in 1990. That set off a competition, an extraordinary competition. It's like the March Madness, mm-hmm. To identify the gene itself, to positionally clone the gene itself, which was accomplished in 1994. And Myriad Genetics was the firm that actually pulled out most of that gene and put a patent on it. What had motivated our work beginning in 1974 was the realization that breast cancer clusters in families far more than one would expect by chance, and that there is no straightforward environmental explanation for why that might be true. For example, if asbestosis clusters in families, we can say, right, it makes sense. People in the same family are similarly exposed. There was nothing like that in these very large number of families with many cases of breast cancer, many cases of ovarian cancer. So I set out in the mid-70s with the help of an older generation of exclusively gentlemen surgeons to try to determine if there was a genetic link to inherited predisposition for breast cancer. And in 1990, we had proof not only that it was true, but where the gene lay.
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about you doing that kind of work in the 70s and 80s, because I'm not even sure if the Human Genome Project had even begun, let alone concluded.
We didn't have the name.
So how were you doing that kind of research? You didn't have the technology that exists today.
Right. That's a great question. Geneticists are either renowned or notorious, depending on your point of view, for pushing the envelope technologically. What we did first was math. And what we did second was exploit the technology that existed then, which was the capacity to evaluate genetic markers on chromosomes, just small bits of DNA, to determine if they were co-inherited with the condition we were concerned about, with breast cancer and ovarian cancer. It's why it took so long. It's why it took 17 years mm-hmm. to identify the precise map location of BRCA1. The irony, the delight, is that now that project would be less than the dissertation of a graduate student. It's absolutely remarkable how the technology has moved. And that's what the Human Genome Project facilitated, was both the sequencing of the entire human genome. The word genome didn't exist.
I was going to say it didn't, did it?
These were genes, not a genome.
A lot of people, maybe a month or so ago, learned abruptly about BRCA1 and BRCA2 because the actress Angelina Jolie had a double mastectomy after it was detected in her that she had both of these genes. Her mother died of ovarian cancer.
Correct.
And I think that many people might have known that there were genetic mm-hmm. links, but really that particular public spotlight from a beautiful star mm-hmm. from Hollywood really sort of changed, I think, the thinking of women who might carry this gene.
I think it has certainly brought attention to the reality of it. When I first read the piece, I said to my colleague, golly, I think Angelina Jolie is for breast cancer what Rock Hudson was for AIDS. And he said, but Angelina Jolie is going to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. Her piece was excellent. It's worth pointing out, I think, that Angelina Jolie's situation is an extremely common one amongst families that are that have many women with breast or ovarian cancer, but that half of the women, 50% of the women who have mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2 have inherited those mutations from their fathers. I say this in honor of Father's Day, mm-hmm. but it is also scientifically true. And in those families, it's often the case that there are very few breast or ovarian cancer cases because, of course, the fathers are not affected. And with small families, it may just be that by genetic good luck, there are no sisters of the father who inherited the mutation. So we need to be alert for the possibility that a woman can carry such a mutation, even if her mother is completely unaffected and there's no family history on her mother's side. One of the tremendous advantages of having the patents now abrogated is that testing can be made much more widespread so that this kind of situation can be revealed.
When, in 1990, when you and your lab found the site of this gene mm-hmm. and the fact that it could be mutated, was the next step, well, let's make a test to detect if women have it?
The next step was, let's positionally clone the gene. Let's identify the gene. It's a mark of how far the technology has come that the term positional cloning isn't even used anymore. My undergraduates here at UW say, positional cloning, what's that? And I get a huge laugh, and the TAs get a huge laugh. But now we go directly to sequence, and that was the goal at the time, but it took 4 years.
And that is what Myriad Genetics in Utah did.
Well, many groups were working on the same project. What was necessary to do because of the limitations of technology then was to sequence the whole region base pair by base pair. And I do mean base pair by base pair, one base pair at a time. We read them off to each other in my lab. The region I now know in retrospect where we had localized the gene was about 1 million base pairs, and we sequenced through most of it by hand, 300 base pairs at a time, reading them by hand and typing them into a typewriter. Myriad had the tremendous advantage that they had a great deal more money than any of the public sector labs, and consequently could simply do that faster. Also, in retrospect, we realized that we had pieces of the gene identified, but they didn't happen to include bits of the gene that had mutations in the families we were working with, so we didn't know it.
And then Myriad patented that what they had sequenced?
Yeah. Your tone of confusion is real. No, it's real because we were all confused by it. When in September of 1994, they identified virtually all of the sequence of BRCA1, they applied for a patent on it. It was not the first time anyone had ever applied for a patent on the gene, although the scope of their patent and then the aggressiveness with which they pursued it were completely unprecedented. No one anticipated, not even the most senior people in our scientific establishment in America, anticipated this level of aggressive attempt to exclude everyone else. I've been asked in the last couple of days, did it occur to me in 1990 when we had the location to say, oh, well, I'm going to patent this batch of DNA because I know that within here lies this gene. And I thought, what an interesting question. It never crossed my mind. Never crossed my mind.
We're talking with Dr. Mary Claire King. She and her lab in 1990 discovered that indeed BRCA1 existed, proving that there was a genetic link for some breast and ovarian cancers. That's right, isn't it? There are some that are not caused by BRCA1 and BRCA2.
That's a very good point, and I'm glad you made it. The proportion of breast and ovarian cancer that's attributable, that's due to mutations BRCA1 and BRCA2, is a minority of it, depending on the particular ancestry of a woman's family. It may be anywhere from 10% to 25% of breast or ovarian cancer that's due to these genes. Most is not.
Okay, just to clarify.
Right.
So what did it mean, practically speaking, when Myriad applied and received a patent for this?
Right. Well, it took quite a long time to settle out. At first, Myriad attempted to enforce their patent against researchers as well as in the commercial sphere, that is, against those of us who were carrying out research on these genes, for which no money was changing hands at all. We were publicly funded. We were attempting to understand what the genes did. We were understanding variations in sequence. And they sent notices to many people in the field, including me, that we should cease and desist. Christine Gregoire, who was then the Attorney General, immediately sent a team to my lab. We notified risk assessment at UW, and I said, I have no experience with all this. Do I really have to stop my life's work? I'd been doing it since I was in my 20s. And they said, hold that thought. Christine Gregoire sent a team. The team responded to Myriad, and that was the end of it. I never heard another peep. And so I've continued my research. Again, it's non-commercial. There's no money changing hands. Nobody pays me to be tested. I have NIH grants and grants from foundations that have just kept me alive in all of this. And for virtually all public sector researchers who are not doing commercial work, that's been the case. Meanwhile, Myriad enforced very aggressively their claim to be the only laboratory that could carry out commercial, that is, insurance reimbursable or patient paid, testing for mutations in these genes. A few years ago in Europe, a group of geneticists and physicians and patients appealed to the European Patent Office to nullify those patents, and they were successful. So in Europe, for several years, the patent has been abrogated, and women can have testing through public sector, through private sectors. There's been a marketplace at work. In Israel, the patents were ignored from the beginning. But in the U.S., we've had this situation in which a woman, in order to be tested, had to be tested at this one company. That was a difficulty, particularly in the earlier days, because the approach that they used, while perfectly, they were doing it perfectly competently, did not detect all classes of mutations. So there were many women with mutations who were being told that they had a normal sequence when they didn't. And we and others revealed that in about 2005, 2006. They added a test, still more money. So now they were doing two tests, and it remained an unsatisfactory situation, as well as a very expensive one for patients, their families, their physicians, so on.
That test runs at least $3,000. I don't have the
much more than that. I don't have the exact details either, but it's considerably more than that.
So yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that Myriad couldn't patent the genes, but they could patent something called cDNA. Mm. What is that?
Right. So cDNA is a form of DNA that one works with in the lab by removing it from the cell where it originally lay and setting it up in a small construct so one can work with it without the non-coding bits. So it's only the coding bits. It's an interesting legal point that they make a distinction between cDNA and genomic DNA, that is, the genes. It will make work for patent lawyers, but it will have absolutely no effect on testing. All testing is done on genomic DNA, whether it's by the conventional Sanger sequencing method that Myriad still uses, or by modern tools such as genomic technology that are used in public sector labs.
Lately, patenting in general and the patent trolls have been in the news, and it got us to wondering how widespread gene patenting is. Mm-hmm. Is it beyond BRCA1 and 2?
Yeah, gene patenting has become very widespread in the last few years, and it's been a real problem for physicians who need to have their patients tested for mutations in a wide variety of genes, particularly now that it's possible to carry out genome-wide testing. My young colleague Jay Shindery in our Department of Genome Sciences here at UW published a beautiful paper a few months ago revealing a non-invasive test for prenatal full genome sequencing of a fetus. Can you believe it?
No, I can't believe it.
It's totally fabulous. And imagine if every time the Shindery test bumped up against a patent. It has been chaos. Hopefully this will completely abrogate that problem.
I was going to ask, clearly this was about a specific gene, but the ruling is about any human gene.
Certainly, you're speaking to a geneticist,
right?
Not a patent lawyer.
So you're just saying sure.
Yeah, I'd say sure. I mean, it reads that way. I mean, people need to read it and evaluate it. But the commentaries I've heard, of course, on NPR in the last 24 hours would suggest that this is the way that lawyers are reading this ruling also, that this is intended to be generalized. Genes are product of nature, not only BRCA1 and BRCA2, but all genes.
And how many of them are in our body?
About 22,000.
That's a lot of genes.
Yeah.
Does yesterday's ruling have a direct impact on what you and your lab are doing?
Oh, yes, very much so. A couple of years ago, my young colleague Tom Walsh and the rest of us in the lab developed an approach for sequencing using modern genomics tools, BRCA1, BRCA2, and about 30 other genes that are more minor players in this predisposition to breast and ovarian cancer. And we have been happily using it for research purposes for the last, well, since late 2010. A few months ago, the UW Hospital asked if they could use our test for patient referrals for commercial purposes, for insurance reimbursable purposes. And we said yes, and we helped Colin Pritchard and John Tate set up the test. And they've been going along using it very successfully, except that they had to mask BRCA1 and BRCA2, which of course are at the heart of the story. As of this morning, the masks are gone. And they are now using our test through the hospital. They can have referrals from all over the country, all over the world, and they can reveal everything about all of the genes. So what had been an impediment to full testing for patients who were referred by their physicians through the University of Washington system is now no longer an impediment. And of course, that makes us feel terrific because we developed this test for them in the first place.
Well, so it has more direct results for the patients than necessarily for your lab.
Oh, the impact will be for patients. The impact of this ruling is for women who are concerned that they carry mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2 that might predispose to breast cancer, or indeed people who are concerned that they might carry mutations in any genes that could predispose them or their as yet unborn children to any other complex chronic condition that we are concerned about. So it's a tremendous victory.
I know that there are at least a few people in biotech, in the biotech industry yesterday who said that they worried that the ruling might have a chilling effect by, in fact, disincentivizing you to be able to make money off of your research.
Well, so let me make a subtle point. This is not a point I would try anywhere except on NPR, right? There is this ruling pertains to genes. There is a vast difference between both the intellectual and the economic way of operationalizing gene discovery compared to drug development. So for gene discovery, virtually all of the investment of time and creativity is upfront, as that's what 1974 to 1990 in my lab. The amount of work required to put into the marketplace a genetic test once the gene is discovered is very small. I mean, it's days. Hmm. There is no phase 3 trial. There is no FDA approval process. It is a direct application to the marketplace. In contrast, for drug development, there is a vast post-discovery period that costs hundreds of millions of dollars. This Supreme Court ruling does not bear on that at all. Not at all. It does not in any way disrupt any of that process. This is a specifically genetics ruling that applies, of course, in my view, appropriately to a very different kind of scientific creativity and market operationalization.
Mary Claire King is professor of genome sciences and medicine at the University of Washington, and she discovered the BRCA1 gene in 1990 after more than a decade of work.
Right.
Thank you for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
Speaking of science, there are a lot of new science awards out there, and some of them come with huge monetary awards. Is that good for science? Maybe, maybe not. Some thoughts on that in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
It's cloudy and 55 degrees in Seattle this morning, and we're looking at a changing weather scene through the day. It's going to wind up partly sunny this afternoon and at least 68. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:26. A new stage show features intimate letters written by famous American dads, including John F. Kennedy and John Steinbeck. We're going to learn more about this play and how it came about in about 10 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. This summer on Weekday, we've added a new topic to our regular lineup, news from the world of science and technology. You probably heard of the Nobel Prize, awarded in several scientific disciplines among other general areas. But what about the Fundamental Physics Prize? That's actually the name of a prize. It came with a $3 million cash award. There's a new generation of science prizes, and maybe it would be better to call them mega prizes. Zia Murali wrote about them in the journal Nature, and I talked to her earlier today and asked her to describe what these mega prizes are.
You know, recently, I guess within the past year or so, we've seen a number of very big money prizes being announced in for science. We've seen a $3 million prize being announced for physics, another $3 million prize for the life sciences, and, you know, a couple of other prizes at over $1.5 million that really seem to be trying to compete with the Nobel Prizes in terms of prestige. I guess the idea behind them is that they've been set up by individuals or groups of individuals or billionaires who have made money, you know, through big business, through internet investments and things like that, and who are now saying that they want to give something back to society and in particular to encourage research in science by giving these big prizes to recognize achievements.
In your article, you said at least one of the prizes was hoping that they would create a scientific award that's the equivalent of our Oscar award, that in fact they're looking for stardom for scientists.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that that the founders said to me when I was speaking to them was that they felt that it's kind of wrong the way that society seems to value actors and actresses and football players and sports stars much more than perhaps people who are finding or attempting to find cures for diseases and sort of probably having more of an impact on our everyday lives than some of these celebrities. And so I guess it's not so much to run down the celebrities that we have, but to try and boost up the status of, you know, good scientists who are doing lots of good work and making progress, and to try and encourage young people to want to be scientists when they grow up.
Well, on the surface, that seems like a wonderful thing. And if you were going to win $3 million, I'm sure you'd be pretty thrilled. But not all scientists were quite as delighted by the ideas, I suppose, the organizers of the awards might have hoped.
No, that's true. I think initially people were excited that so much money was being donated back into science. But when they sort of sat back and thought about it, the problem was that this money is being concentrated down onto a very few individuals, often individuals that already have reached the pinnacle of their fields. They're already very well paid and very well recognized. They've already won lots of awards. And so the question is, what exactly is the benefit of giving them more money? So that's not to sort of suggest that they don't deserve recognition, but it's just a question of, if you want to put more money back into science, is it better to give it to a few individuals, or is it better to try and perhaps encourage research in other ways, give smaller amounts to more people, give prizes that would encourage people to do new research towards specific goals? You know, that those are the sort of questions that have been coming up.
There's also that idea of, as you mentioned, the encouraging research as opposed to rewarding the outcome of it. So funding something that you don't know will succeed. And there's not that much. There aren't that many kind of pools of money, at least in the United States, for research anymore that doesn't have a known outcome. I don't know about Britain.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, people sort of talked about the X Prize and how, you know, you can sort of put in, there have been famous competitions where people have put in a lot of money or offered a lot of money for people to solve certain problems, perhaps, to, you know, for innovation in terms of getting into space or something like that. But those are quite sort of ambitious goals. But perhaps there's, you know, a lot of room for similar prizes that innovate research, but with sort of goals that perhaps have more of an impact on all of our lives. So problems to do with perhaps climate change or dealing with climate change, things like that, where, you know, people are struggling to find answers, and maybe it would be good to come in there and put up a prize and say, can you solve this problem?
In terms of the amount of money for these mega prizes, there, you know, we're talking about $3 million, more than $3 million. And you mentioned in your article there are prizes for mathematics, there are other sorts of prizes, but I'm wondering, these just seem such large pots of money, and it's so kind of glittery. The allure of winning them would be very tempting, and it seems like it would kind of put you on the course to a certain type of research that you might not have considered if nobody was dangling that kind of golden carrot in front of you.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, it's something that I asked somebody, you know, Frank Wilczek, who had won a Nobel Prize. I asked him, you know, did the thought of winning a Nobel Prize change the course of his research? You know, was that sort of a carrot that was dangled in front of him and made him want to sort of carry out research in a certain direction? And he sort of said, well, no, to be honest, you can't really think that way. You're not going to be able to, you know, come up with brilliant ideas just for the money. And I think that is sort of a slight difference in terms of scientific research compared with, you know, offering a lot of money to people to go into banking. It has to be something you're really excited about. It has to be something you're passionate about. And lots of scientists find very obscure and very particular areas that they really enjoy. And I think, you know, if there is a big prize at the end of it, that's a wonderful bonus. But I don't think it could really make them change their research direction just to get that prize.
I was just imagining, you know, the actors who take roles because they know this is a surefire Academy Award winning role. And, you know, we joke in the United States that if you if you either gain a lot of weight or lose a lot of weight or obscure your beauty, you're sure to win a prize. But you're saying scientists really aren't motivated by that same sort of thing. Just a last question has to do with the Nobels themselves. These are esteem prizes. The fact that you would call anybody who could put Nobel-winning scientist, Nobel-winning researcher, Nobel-winning writer, it has such a cachet. Do you imagine a point where any of these prizes will reach that level of cachet?
You know, they may well do, but it will take time. And, you know, I've actually spoken to the people, you know, at the Nobel, sort of working with the Nobel Committee, who sort of pointed out that it took a long time for the Nobel to achieve that level of prestige. And I think there's no reason why these prizes perhaps couldn't, but it will take a lot of time. It'll be a question of decades and whether they can choose really good winners, and perhaps, you know, perhaps those winners will then go on to win Nobel Prizes to kind of vindicate these prizes. But yeah, you know, certainly there could be a point where, you know, scientists look to the Fundamental Physics Prize as a more prestigious prize than the Nobel's. Why not?
Zia Murali, her article on science mega prizes appears in the latest issue of the journal Nature. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:35. Letters from Fathers in a minute.
KUOW and the Future of Flight Foundation present NASA astronaut Mike Forman, who will discuss his experience aboard the International Space Station Saturday, June 15th at the Future of Flight Aviation Center in Mukilteo. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Our relationship to money and consuming goes back a long way. So too does the question, how much is enough?
The ancient philosophers knew of insatiability. You know, the myth of Midas, the man who wants to turn everything into gold, that's clearly about insatiability.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back then, maybe a different answer from today. Consumed. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APM.
Tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to protect the waters of Puget Sound and the native salmon and orca that live there. More information at earthjustice.org. Earth Justice, because the earth needs a good lawyer.
It's 55 degrees in Seattle, and we're expecting some sun later today. At the moment, we're under a blanket of clouds, and that's not unusual for us this time of year. So what's the deal with the springtime cloud cover here in the Puget Sound region? Apparently, there's a scientific reason for it. Washington State climatologist Nick Bond will explain that for us in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Fathers, if you were leaving behind one message to your children in a letter, what would you say? How do you transcend the day-to-day and write words of advice and love that they could carry with them their entire lives? Paul Morgan Stettler has been a Seattle actor for 20 years. He's the co-founder of the New Century Theater Company. His latest work is a curated theater piece called Dear Dad, a performance of letters written by famous fathers, which is playing this Sunday at 2 p.m. and at 7 p.m. at ACT Theater. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So this is a play of letters from famous fathers to their children. Why did you get interested in letters from fathers?
You know, I kind of stumbled across it. I'm a fairly new father myself. I have a son who's about to turn 4 tomorrow and a daughter who turned 1 in May. About a year ago, I sat down to write my son a letter. My father did that to me when I was a kid, and I thought it was a great idea, and it could be touching. I wanted to tell him how I felt about him. And struggling, I'm a terrible procrastinator, so I thought that I would break out the letter that my father sent to me. I hadn't read it in years, to see if it would inspire me to write my son. When I read it originally, I wasn't a father, and reading it again, it just leapt out at me, and it just really started to get me to think about letter writing and correspondence and the way it's changed so much, and how, you know, getting a letter from your father or from your parent, how touching and personal that can be. And then that just got me into thinking about other fathers, and I went online, and there's just a treasure trove of wonderful letters that have been posted from famous people or anonymous people that write beautifully about something to their kids, and I just started putting it together, and I'm a theater artist, and it just made sense that this would fit in that kind of NPR-like moth, you know, short stories live realm. And so I spoke to ACT about it, and they were game, and we're going to give it a go on Sunday.
So what was it about your father's letter that stood out to you when you were reading it over again?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I was struggling with writing to my son was he was going through an emotional period and a lot of it was being very connected to his mother and not so much to me. And I was taking it kind of personally. And so when I read this letter again, there was some wording in here. My father was an English professor, and he chose his words he didn't choose them lightly, that made me realize that maybe I wasn't the easiest kid in the world either. So I thought that actually helped me move forward in my thoughts about just having to take the baton and keep moving on.
Do you want to read us an example of something he...
Sure.
Some advice or reflection he gave you?
Well, sure. This is a letter written in 1965. I was not even 2 years old. And it's the original letter. It's a typewritten sheet of paper that was folded in half. It's handwritten, and it reads, "Dear Paul, the other day I wrote a letter to your older brother Pete, in which I tried to tell him how I felt about him. While I feel almost all such attempts at communicating one's emotions are failures, I thought you might enjoy a similar effort on my part. It so happens this is a rather appropriate day for such a letter. It is your mother's and my 10th wedding anniversary. You've only been with us for 23 months of those 10 years, but already you've done quite a bit for us. Most important, I feel, is a sense of balance you've been able to add to our family. And the way you've done this has been through your very independent but lovable personality. One quality you share with Pete, an excellent sense of humor. I hope you never lose this. It's a guarantee to keep your mind healthy. Also, you've got an alertness that I'm sure is indicative of a good mind. In addition, you've got a fierce determination that could be your biggest ally for success. I've been a believer in the idea that the happy man, and I equate success with happiness, is the man who can stick at something that he wants deeply and as a result eventually get it, or at least enough of it. The old saying, hard work pays off, may be a bromide, but that doesn't make it any less truthful. Here's hoping you never lose this determination. If you ever find it flagging, perhaps this letter might help you restore it."
So when he was writing that, you're 2 years old. what audience do you think he was playing to? Was he picturing you as the man you are now reading it?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think I read it when I was probably 28 or in my mid-20s the first time. And I think that might have been what he was thinking about. And when I think about my son growing older, I'm thinking that in his early adulthood. But reading it at my age now, I'm 49, it has so much more meaning. So I feel like I'm having a conversation with him now because I actually understand what he went through as I'm going through it myself. So I found that to be really powerful.
Do you find that his insights about who you were at two were true?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I would have liked to have read his, brought this letter out a few times because there were moments when my determination was flagging and to have that pat on the back, that emotional pat on the back and sort of saying, keep going for it is an important thing.
I'm speaking with Paul Stettler. He's a Seattle actor, and he's putting on a show this weekend at the ACT Theater called Dear Dad, which is a performance of letters written by famous fathers. Well, let's look at some of those famous fathers for a second. We've decided that we think it would be more fun for you to read part of the letter or the letter in its entirety and then tell us who the famous father is at the end of it.
Yeah.
So let's read one that stands out to you.
Well, this one was written in 1971. And it was received by a young man a few days before his wedding. And it was written by his adopted father from his father's first marriage. June 1971. Dear Mike, you've heard all the jokes that have been rousted around by all the unhappy marrieds and cynics. Now, in case no one has suggested it, there is another viewpoint. You have entered into the most meaningful relationship there is in all human life. It can be whatever you decide to make it. Some men feel their masculinity can be only proven if they play out in their own life all the locker room stories, smugly confident that what a wife doesn't know won't hurt her. The truth is, somehow, way down inside, without her ever finding lipstick on the collar of a man or catching a man in the flimsy excuse of where he was till 3 a.m., a wife does know. And with that knowing, some of the magic of this relationship disappears. There's an old law of physics that you can only get out of a thing as much as you put in it. The man who puts into the marriage only half of what he owns will get that out. Sure, there will be moments when you will see someone or think back to an earlier time, and you'll be challenged to see if you can still make the grade. But let me tell you how really great is the challenge of proving your masculinity and charm with only one woman for the rest of your life. Any man can find a twerp here and there who will go along with cheating. And it doesn't take all that much manhood. It does take quite a man to remain attractive and to be loved by a woman who has heard him snore, seen him unshaven, tended him while he was sick, and washed his dirty underwear. Do that and keep her still feeling a warm glow, and you will know some very beautiful music. If you truly love a girl, you shouldn't ever want her to feel, when she sees you greet a secretary or a girl you both know, that humiliation of wondering if she was someone who caused you to be late coming home. Nor should you want any other woman to be able to meet your wife and know she was smiling behind her eyes as she looked at her, the woman you love, remembering this was the woman you rejected even momentarily for her favors. There is no greater happiness for a man than approaching a door at the end of the day, knowing someone on the other side of that door is waiting for the sound of his footsteps. Love, Dad.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice, a wonderful perspective on acknowledging it's not easy, but it's worthwhile if you really put your whole heart and soul into it.
So who was the author of that letter?
The author of this letter was Ronald Reagan, who at the time was the governor of California. And I don't know the details. I know that his first marriage was not good, and so maybe that's what he's referring to. And then his wife, his marriage with Nancy Reagan lasted 50-some years. So obviously he found the bliss that he found in his marriage. So,
when you read these letters, does it just change how you feel about these different historical figures?
Absolutely. You know, you get to know them, certainly in this case, you know, a political figure, and you may put them in the box of their political leanings, and you don't realize they have... they have a personal life and they have a way mm-hmm. of looking at things. I found some other letters from Reagan on a great website called lettersofnote.com. And a young boy wrote him when he was president saying, my mother has declared my room a disaster area and I'm writing for federal relief. And Reagan wrote this beautiful letter back saying, well, we're looking for some volunteers, and we think that you can volunteer to help clean up your room, and we've got our eye on it. And it's just this wonderfully funny and sensitive letter. So I just gave me a whole new perspective on him, yeah.
Fathers, we're asking the question, basically, if you were leaving behind one message to your children in a letter, what would you say? And we're doing it through the lens of the letters that Paul Stettler, Seattle actor, has collected for his performance this Sunday called Dear Dad at the ACT Theater, all letters by different famous fathers to their children. Let's read another one. Let's do one more.
Sure. This one's great. This is from F. Scott Fitzgerald in 1933. And he was writing his daughter, Scotty, who was 11 years old. She was away at camp. The tone of this letter just is priceless, because there's clearly a battle of wills going on between the two of them. Towson, Maryland, August 8th, 1933. Dear Pi, I am glad you are happy, but I never believe much in happiness. I never believe in misery either. Those are things you see on the stage or the screen or the printed pages. They never really happen to you in life. I think of you, and always pleasantly, but if you call me Pappy again, I am going to take the white cat out and beat his bottom hard 6 times for every time you are impertinent. Do you react to that? Half-wit, I will conclude. Things to worry about. Worry about courage. Worry about cleanliness. Worry about efficiency. Worry about horsemanship. Worry about things not to worry about. Don't worry about popular opinion. Don't worry about dolls. Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about growing up. Don't worry about anybody getting ahead of you. Don't worry about triumph. Don't worry about failure unless it comes through your own fault. Don't worry about mosquitoes. Don't worry about flies. Don't worry about insects in general. Don't worry about parents. Don't worry about boys. Don't worry about disappointments. Don't worry about pleasures. Don't worry about satisfactions. Things to think about. What am I really aiming at? How good am I, really, in comparison to my contemporaries in regard to A, scholarship? B, do I really understand about people, and am I able to get along with them? C, am I trying to make my body a useful instrument, or am I neglecting it? With dearest love, Daddy. P.S. My comeback to your calling me Pappy is christening you by the word egg, which implies that you belong to a very rudimentary state of life, and that I could break you up and crack you open at my will, and I think it would be a very good word to hang on you if I ever told it to your contemporaries. Egg Fitzgerald. How would you like to go through life with Eggy Fitzgerald, or Bad Egg Fitzgerald, or any form that might occur to fertile minds? Try it once more, and I swear to God I will hang it on you, and it will be up to you to shake it off. Why borrow trouble? Love, anyhow.
What do you like about that letter?
I just love that he is arguing with her almost on her own terms. You know, he's not above sarcasm to an 11-year-old. And one, there's a section I didn't talk about, but he actually asks her to go to his camp library and find a Shakespeare sonnet that reads, "Lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds." So he's talking to her on a very intelligent level, but he's also in some ways arguing with her on an 11-year-old's wavelength as well. I just be very curious what the relationship was like.
From the letters I was given that you sent to us, I was struck by how adult most of these people address their children.
Yeah, absolutely. My wife and I read all of these letters just to sort of see how the show is going to go, and she looked up and she said, boy, they were smarter than we are. And I think part of it is, again, the way we communicate. We've gotten to the point where we don't have to spell a whole word. We just can, you know, condense everything. And at the time, they had to sit down and they would concentrate on what they were going to say. It took time to communicate. And these letters took a while to get there. And I'm curious how kids today are going to remember their parents and how that correspondence is going to take shape.
Are you hoping that fathers seeing your play on Sunday take action and
Absolutely. I think it was, you know, I finally did write my letter to my son, and it took a while because I really wanted to put my time into it. And it was so easy to try to go online and procrastinate. But once you finally get into it, it feels good. And it feels like it was a worthwhile thing. And I hope to do more of it. And I hope other parents, and not just parents, but kids writing to their parents, mm-hmm. write a letter to your dad.
Can you tell us what your main takeaway message that you were trying to leave your kids with was?
I think it was around Christmas time, and the thing that really struck me was we would give him a present, and we showered him with too many gifts, and our sensibility was open the gift and then get to the next one. And he just wanted to play with the gift that he was given. He had no interest in going to the next one, and I loved the fact that he wanted to enjoy what was in front of him. And so I talked a little bit about that and how he taught me to take a little more time and to enjoy what's in front of me.
Paul Stettler is a Seattle actor. He's performing his show this Sunday, June 16th at 2 p.m. and at 7 p.m. at the ACT Theater, a curated theater piece called Dear Dad. It's a performance of letters written by famous fathers. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
This is Weekday. Great. That was perfect.
Yeah.
And now.
And now.
This is the sound,
Of the week.
Of the week.
Of the week. Oh, yes, of
the sound of the week.
Well, you can probably tell that that's somebody laughing hysterically. It's Alex. Alex's 10-month-old, I'm not sure if it's a boy or a girl, laughing hysterically as the two of them fly across the room. That's good. That's a good one. I hope everybody experiences joy like that this weekend. What are you listening to that's fun, adorable, interesting, or just going to be thought-provoking? We'd love you to record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. Nick Bond, are we going to be laughing about the weather this weekend?
Yes, I think the weather gods are being benevolent. Certainly, it looks like it's going to be warmer weather than today, in which the kind of deeper layer of marine air with plenty of clouds has kind of surged in. And so we should get some breaks this afternoon, but it'll just get to the upper 60s. But by tomorrow, maybe mid to high 70s and mostly sunny.
Yay!
Hey, so there you go.
see, even the audience is laughing with you.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, a repeat on Sunday. Probably a couple of degrees cooler as some kind of mid and high level clouds drift over, but just a minimal chance of rain here. The high country, maybe a few scattered showers, but again, getting back to the weather gods, while the weekend's pretty nice, then a downturn in the early part of next week through midweek. And so at least if they're going to time the rain, might as well have it during the week, right?
Well, I suppose so, although I could do without it. And I sometimes have to keep reminding myself that it's always like this in June, but for some reason I expect that it's going to be beautiful.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, we can get some sunny and even hot, if not torrid, weather this time of year. And it's gotten me thinking about what really controls how cloudy it is. And getting back to, you know, just how cloudy it is, it looks like about the fewest clouds we can have in June is about 50% or a little bit more on average. Some Junes get up over 80% cloud cover, and the term June gloom is pretty apt then. And so, you know, the question is, what controls it being cloudier in one June versus another? And there, I've been poking around a little bit, and what key appears to be the north-south component of the winds, that when we have north winds, for the more winds from the north than usual, it tends to have fewer clouds, and more winds from the south than usual, there's more clouds than usual.
I thought that the winds were a product of whether it was clear or not, not the other way around.
Well, around here, it's kind of a complicated business, but how much sinking motion versus rising motion in the atmosphere is related to this sense of the north-south component of the winds. And so we tend to have sinking motion, which warms the air and suppresses clouds during the north winds, and that's absent, or there's rising motion kind of enhancing clouds during the south winds. And this even works on a daily time scale, as well as kind of monthly averages. And so you can, it's not a hard and fast rule, but you could actually use that for a morning like today in which the winds are mostly out of the south. You have to kind of expect, well, this is going to be mostly a cloudy one. But if even if there's some morning clouds, if the winds are out of the north, then chances are it's going to be a pretty nice afternoon.
Do the winds shift from south to north at a particular time of year, or is it a function of cloud cover?
Yeah, and that's a very insightful question. In fact, they do shift right around the 4th of July or afterwards. We get into much more of the north winds than the south winds, and it's not a coincidence that's when we tend to clear out. We have twice as many clear days in July as we do in June, and just about half as many cloudy days. And so that it's a kind of a subtle change in the pressure patterns, but it seems to make all the difference around here.
Yeah. Well, I for one, will look forward to probably some north winds over the weekend, right? Because we're going to have sunny skies?
Yeah, well, certainly in the afternoons.
Okay.
But then, again, a different story midweek where we can look for some showers at times. Some of them have pretty decent rain rates out of them. But again, it looks like next weekend, tentative forecast is a long-range one, is apt to be pretty nice again.
I will cross my fingers and we'll check in with you again next Friday to see if that really is going to hold true.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Thanks, Nick. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean, and he's here every Friday with a weather look for us. And looks like Father's Day, whether you're celebrating alone with family or taking a hike, you can expect some pretty sunny weather. And Bernard, I look forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it, too.
Good.
It's 9:59. Goats are being used as lawnmowers across Seattle. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Farmers and Ranchers. The Washington Grown Project celebrates family-owned and operated farms and ranches, which produce milk, hay, and pears for Washington State and the world. Learn more at wagrown.com.
Jazzman Terrence Blanchard, trumpeter, has some new music out. Terrence Blanchard from his new album, Magnetic. We're going to talk with him and hear more of his new music this afternoon at 1:45.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Regional Heart Center, where patients from the Puget Sound area and throughout the Pacific Northwest region receive multidisciplinary comprehensive cardiovascular care. More information at uwmedicine.org.
Degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. It'll be partly sunny.